I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Within a day, the streets of Baltimore went from fires, smoke, and tear gas to places where communities gathered, cleaned up, and even celebrated. Last night, the mayor's week-long curfew went into effect with limited defiance. All in all, Tuesday demonstrations were peaceful. But still looming for the city is the investigation into the death of Freddie Gray, who died April 19th from injuries sustained in police custody. The report on the police department's investigation is expected to be turned over to state's attorney Marilyn Mosby on Friday. We'll talk about that on the show today, as well as the city council and gangs, 300 men march in the streets of Baltimore, and an East Side church looks to rebuild after a fire. That's Midday after the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR, WYPF, WYPO, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. However you're listening, we thank you for joining us as we continue our coverage and conversation about Baltimore's state of emergency. At this hour in downtown Baltimore, ministers are holding a rally and prayer vigil outside the state's attorney's office for what they call a rally for police accountability. Later in this week, we're expecting the Baltimore Police Department to complete its investigation of the Freddie Gray death and turn over that report of that investigation to State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. That's supposed to be happening on Friday. One of the things we'll be talking about in this hour of the show. One of the ministers taking part in that demonstration downtown is the Reverend Dante Hickman of Southern Baptist Church in East Baltimore. He's among those participating. We hope to have him on the show today in the second hour of Midday because next to his church, there was a community center and apartments for senior citizens under construction. That's the facility that burned down Monday night. And so we hope to hear from Reverend Hickman later in the show today after that rally. A lot of ground to cover here in the early hour of the show, the first hour of the show, 410-662-8780. Open phone lines for you to join us. I want to welcome to our studio once again Munir Bahar of the 300 Men March, who's been out in the streets of Baltimore ever since the troubled start. Well, he's been out in the streets of Baltimore a lot over the last couple of years, especially in the last few days. And we're going to hear from him in a little while about what's been going on with his 300 Men March in the streets of Baltimore. Munir, nice to see you again.
Yes, thank you, Dan. Good to see you as well.
And Doug Donovan is here, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, because one of the things we're going to talk about is an interesting story that the Sun, Doug, and Luke Broadwater and Mark Puente had in the paper today about a collaboration, an alliance, some teamwork between members of the Baltimore City Council and members of gangs in Baltimore. So, Doug, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
But we start with P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff, who is fresh in from the street. He was visiting Frederick Douglass High School this morning. Kenny, nice to see you again.
Thank you, Dan.
Tell us what was happening at the high school.
Well, it started around 9 o'clock this morning. School CEO Gregory Thornton stopped by. He wanted to welcome the students back first and foremost, but he also wanted to hear their concerns and also relay to them the message that what happened in the last several days will not define their future.
We're talking about Frederick Douglass High School because the
Frederick Douglass High School is near Mondawmin Mall, which is where the riots began around 3 o'clock. Let's start with the students, if I could, because they feel they are being unfairly portrayed as the participants of what happened, largely because they don't get out of school until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the riots started around 3 o'clock. Also keep in mind, the subway station not too far from the high school is really a major hub for really all of the schools. For those not familiar with Baltimore City, students get to and from classes through MTA buses, and that's one of the major transfer points for school students.
Well, then how did Frederick Douglass High School get implicated in this, or the students from that?
There was a lot of talk definitely in the media that because of the proximity of Douglass to Mondawmin, to the church, New Shalom Baptist Church, where the funeral for Freddie Gray took place, and they said they saw the uniforms. Now, generally, your school uniforms do have khaki pants, but you really have to look at the shirts to determine which school the students attended. For example, Douglass is navy blue and orange.
What was the point of this meeting today? Just to hear from the students or to speak to the students? What was going on there?
Well, Dr. Jordan wanted to hear from the students and talk to the students and make sure that their needs were, their concerns were being heard. He's going to, in the near future, arrange something with the school police chief as well as police commissioner Anthony Batts. About a half hour after he left, Pastor Jamal Bryan from Empowerment Temple shows up with Wale, who, for those who are unfamiliar, a very popular hip-hop artist, to talk to the students and really try to figure out the best way they can move forward as far as expressing their frustration and really becoming leaders of their own image.
So what you heard from the students was that they weren't there.
They weren't there.
They think it's unfair for them to be implicated in this because of the hour they are actually released from school.
Yes.
All right. So is there any other reason to believe that Douglas students were involved in instigating this the riots?
From my personal view, I don't really see anything. It's just a bad case of circumstances, meaning the school just happens to be close to where the riots took place. I haven't heard anything as far as confirming which students from which schools participated.
All right. Thank you, Kenny. And I just note there, 235 arrests on Monday, according to the Baltimore City Police, 34 of them juveniles.
Right.
Doug Donovan from The Sun.
Well, what I find interesting about what he's saying is Monday night around midnight after the new Shiloh Baptist Church meeting with ministers and gang members went down to North Avenue in Fulton where the car was on fire. These were not students who were throwing bottles. These were grown men wearing masks taller than me coming out of the shadows, coming out of the alley, standing in the middle of the street throwing bottles at police officers. None of them struck me as middle school students. I don't know, maybe high school.
I had the same observation at the intersection of Monroe and North Avenue where I saw you, Munir, on Monday night. I got there a little later, like 6:15, 6:30. So.
Yeah, I was there around midnight, so maybe the younger students were gone, but the ones I saw were, grown men.
What did Wale have to say to the students?
Well, he said he came all the way from New York to hear their concerns. There was one exchange that I saw, and I'll try and include it in the story that we're going to air later. One student was just frustrated with the cameras and the intention. He said, if you really care about us, if you really want to address our concerns, forget the cameras, forget the media, just come to us one-on-one.
Good. All right, Kenny Burns, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
P. Kenneth Burns, reporter for WYPR News. And I mentioned Munir Bahar. Saw Munir out on the street on Monday night while all this was still going on. Actually, it was getting to be sunset when I saw you, Munir. And Munir's been on our show before to talk about the 300 Men March and their efforts, anti-violence efforts in Baltimore City. So you've been out on the street for many hours in the last couple of days. I wonder if you just start by giving us your observations about things, say, yesterday versus Monday, Monday versus yesterday. Just your
Monday, it was a lot more tense. I think it's the Baltimore community is in shock, sort of, of what happened. I think Monday really came. Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen it. I haven't seen anything like that in my life here. You know, and I'm 33 years old. Going into Tuesday, and we were out for 9 hours, and we marched probably for 12, 13 miles.
Yesterday? You did 9 hours yesterday?
We did 9 hours out. We started at 10:30, and we went in about 7:30.
Where were you?
Everywhere in Baltimore. We started down Old Town Mall by the projects. We marched up Monument through East Baltimore, through Milton Street to North Avenue, North Avenue to Pennsylvania, all through Pennsylvania Avenue, through downtown, the Lexington Market, past City Hall, back to the cars.
And I should say for our listeners, a very distinct Munir and his men on the street.
Yeah, they were about black, 150
black,
of us.
Black t-shirts with white lettering that says 300 Men March, and what's that motto underneath there?
Baltimore's anti-violence movement.
Right. Okay.
So yesterday, maybe it was because of our sheer numbers or whatever, but I think yesterday there was a lot of hope being recycled and sort of shared. You know, everywhere we went, people, were sort of applauding and, just saying great things. Baltimore, we're strong, we're united. So a lot of people were hopeful yesterday, despite what happened just the night before. And that's really what our purpose was, is we're just trying to keep that hope, ignited, keep that flame, a positive flame ignited, despite the negative things that are happening. Just trying to really keep people focused. Again, recycling. you know, positive energy.
I'm curious, have you been getting pressure from people to say, yeah, we're anti-violence, we're an anti-violence movement in Baltimore? Do people say to you, Munir, you need to be against the police because the police are violent? Are you hearing that a lot?
I'm going to say we have 90% support and we have 10% folks who feel we should be doing things that they want us to do because we have some influence. I mean, folks want us, even though I have white members of my organization, it's funny, folks think we should be about an all-black empowerment movement. Folks say we should be about police brutality, or we should speak out against it, and we should speak out against government corrupt. Just all these things that people speak out against, and that's no problem. We all have different lanes, but 300 Men March movement, we just focus on the issue of violence, period. One person harming another person, and it just so happens that the majority of that are citizens against citizens in terms of the numbers. So, you know, are we focusing on 98% of an occurrence or 2%? We focus on the 98%. 20-something people have been shot and or murdered just since the Freddie Gray incident.
But, since April 12th?
Yes. There's no hashtag, though. You know, matter of fact, I think just 5 people on Sunday, I think, were shot and killed. There's been a few 18-year-olds, children, 14-year-old, also one who've been, nobody's mentioning. So,
actually, Justin Fenton of The Sun reported yesterday that homicides this year are up 21%.
I believe that was.
Did you see that right, Doug?
Right.
That's what I saw. The 21% at this point versus this point last year. So, Munir, what do you make of what happened on Monday? You separate out the protesters who protested peacefully the death of Freddie Gray, the people who caused, or whoever caused, people involved in melees and destruction Saturday night, and then we get to Monday, which supposedly resulted from a purge, a call for a purge, a day of lawlessness in Baltimore. You have to separate these things out a little bit. So go back to Monday for me, Monday afternoon. What do you make of what happened?
So I think it's important to, and I have to, you know, voice what I know, that there are several groups of opportunists who use that as an opportunity to further dig the hole. You know, there was something, you know, as far as this purge issue of some children doing this, doing something at a mall, you know, we found out that was going to happen sort of early. You know, folks knew. It was being passed around on social media. I think that was one event. It didn't have anything to do with Freddie Gray. You know, that was, let's go loot some stores, you know, the mall or whatever. But it was an opportunity. And whenever chaos, you know, in sort of kicks off, then you have everybody else. Okay, this is an opportunity to now push our cause, to say F the police, to say F the government or whatever. So everybody jumps on board. What's sad is that Freddie Gray's incident is being hijacked by people who really don't care about Freddie Gray. One of my members, who is an older white male, has actually paid a portion of Freddie Gray's funeral. I don't want to say his name. Everybody in Baltimore knows him, but an older white male has paid a portion of Freddie Gray's funeral. But everybody's talking about justice for Freddie Gray, you know, claim they're fighting for Freddie Gray, but yet this man's funeral, it can't even be paid for. And I'm going to just say it by the black folks first and foremost, who were on the front lines yelling black power, black power. And you're not even, you know, so it's so many contradictions.
You don't see any connection between this call for a purge that may have started with high school kids, or maybe a little bit older, and the attitude toward the police stemming from the Freddie Gray death.
Well, again, I just think it was just the moment was ripe to, at that time, take your frustrations out in an uncontrolled manner, no matter what your frustrations were.
Was it ripe because of Freddie Gray's death?
Well, I think, no, it was ripe because
I guess if you didn't have Freddie Gray's death and funeral, I'm asking, would we have seen a purge on the afternoon of April, whatever it was, Monday?
Got you. No, yeah, I think it's because of the hostility that has been brewing based on Freddie Gray's death.
And I think what happened yesterday, speaks to your point, is that the majority of the day you saw this transformation from this horrible night and this horrible afternoon on Monday to really what was a majority positive day. And then at the end, as curfew comes along, you have this small group of people who are agitating again, who get arrested, and the police have to engage them.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think that sort of talks specifically to what you're saying, that there's a small group of people that just want to take advantage when there's an opportunity. And of course, it was at that point at the curfew when most people who are trying to abide by what's going on and keep things peaceful, they come out and they start agitating again. And that, you were talking about that earlier, about how it's this small group of people.
It is.
410-662-8780 is the phone number for Midday. It's Live Talk. With me is Munia Bahar of the 300 Men March and also Doug Donovan of the Baltimore Sun. When we get back, we're going to talk to Doug about his story in the paper today, reporting that rival gangs, Bloods, Crips, Black Guerrilla Family, BGF, came together and released a credible threat to kill police officers. We heard that on Monday. That was put out by the police department. Since that announcement, members of the Bloods appeared on television to deny those claims and even to shun the violence and destruction happening in the city on Monday. Gang members were seen with and praised by Baltimore City Council President Jack Young for their commitment to calming the crowds. We'll talk about that when we get back with Doug Donovan. Munia Bahar in the studio with us. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780.
Last night was a very rough period for our city, but today I think we saw a lot more of what Baltimore is about. We saw people coming together to reclaim our city, to clean our city, and to help heal our city. I think this can be our defining moment and not the darkest days that we saw yesterday.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake of Baltimore at her press conference yesterday afternoon. Also yesterday was another interesting press conference that the Sun calls an unusual tableau, a grouping of people that came together at City Hall.
At City Hall, yes.
Yeah, Doug Donovan from the Sun is with us to talk about this story a little bit.
Yeah, City Council President Jack Young and other City Council members appeared with two members who said that they were members of the Bloods gang. Came about 12 hours after Jack Young appeared at New Shiloh Baptist Church with more than 75 ministers who had a separate meeting with gang members to call for peace, but to also criticize the police department for putting out a threat assessment on Monday saying that the Crips, the Bloods, and the BGF were coming together to target police officers. So you had this meeting yesterday at City Council chambers where you have City Council leaders saying that that threat that the police said was real and credible was not based on what gang members have told him. So I thought that was a pretty, you know, interesting juxtaposition to, you know, take the sides of what gang members are saying over what the police are saying. But given the atmosphere right now, you know, Jack Young's people are saying he's, you know, he's had relationships with gang members in the community for years. And I think, you know, council members should have those relationships. And according to their intelligence, they saw none of the coming together among gangs, and even gang experts said it's very unlikely that gangs would come together to threaten police in the way that the police department has said. Commissioner Batts has said, you know, it was a credible threat, but that's all they can say. They can't provide any information.
Well, okay, but the same is true of Jack Young saying that it's false, saying outright that this report was false. So what is that based on?
Well, it's also it's interesting that they can't come together to threaten police, but they do come together to protect the community, which is what they were saying, that the gang members have come together to help protect the community against the looters and that they were out there, you know, doing good work to protect the community.
In what way? What did they say they did, actually?
That they were protecting certain storefronts and certain places from being attacked. I know, I think Justin Fenton himself, I think, was protected by a Crips member at some point who I happened to meet. And Justin confirmed that. So these stories are true and accurate, but what some gang experts are saying is if you give gangs this type of exposure, this type of stamp of approval from these respectable institutions, you're giving them more power. And if, you know, the majority of the rest of the year, if you're looking at arrests that involve gang members that are quite violent and, you know, organizations that are quite violent, what does that say about, you know, your endorsement of their tactics on one night?
We'd like to hear from our listeners on that. If you have any opinions to share, we have some already posted on Facebook regarding I don't know if we're going to call it an alliance. I don't think we'll go as far as that. What would you call it?
I wouldn't call it an alliance. I think, you know, what Jack Young's people were saying, that in a moment of such intense crisis, right, unprecedented crisis for decades, that you're going to do everything you can to try to quell the violence. And that means reaching out to all types of different community groups, community leaders. And what they're saying is that gang members have those relationships in communities that they might be able to stop the violence.
Comments on Facebook. David says, desperation makes strange bedfellows. Karen says, they ought to swear off their destruction of the community. That would truly benefit the city. Didn't the BGF take over the Baltimore City Jail?
Right, that's a good point.
Yes. Stacy says, city leaders are legitimizing the very groups whose main mission is to kill us with drugs and more than a couple murders a year. You cannot make up insanity like this. They are signing death warrants for this city. These are comments on my Facebook page. John said, nothing Jack Young says or does would surprise me. During, I don't know if this is true, did he refer to Freddie Gray's death as a murder or those who were responsible murderers? Has he said that?
At one point, he did use the word murder.
Okay.
I think he corrected himself to say killing.
Okay. Thank you. John says that during the mayor's press conference Sunday night, he referred to police involved in Freddie Gray's arrest as murderers. I've heard Reverend Jamal Bryant use that term. Brad says, of course, gang members don't want riots. It hurts their business too much. It's so disheartening to see my hometown being run by completely inept leaders. They aren't capable of managing a bake sale, let alone a major American city. More comments are welcome on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page or by email, midday@wypr.org. Munir, you read Doug's story in the paper today.
Yeah.
What do you think of, first of all, do you think it's credible that these self-described gang members would come forward and say, hey, we're not so bad. We're trying to protect and help this community.
No, I called it as, because several people, of course, called me, and I said that I didn't believe that alliance to kill the police or to target police was true. Hmm. Baltimore does not have a gang culture like out west. We don't have the type of gang community and gang culture and protocols like they have. It's grown over the years, but Baltimore originates from a more neighborhood-centric gang type of situation. I wouldn't even call it gangs. We represent neighborhoods. I'm from this neighborhood. So this idea of Bloods and Crips is rather new. They're not as organized as out west, where gangs have been running for decades now. So the piece about the brothers coming together to help protect the community, that I do find credible, believe, because I know for a fact, as we've engaged a lot of young people, gang members, as we've been out, gang is a term, but if you take away the gang, these are just young guys on the streets. You know, I think a lot, we're quick sometimes to label, the same way we're telling folks not to label all police. We can't label all gang members. Some individuals are joining gangs because literally it's their only family, their only means for survival in neighborhoods where if you're not part of the gang, you may be more vulnerable. Mm. So it's more of a social acceptance or choice based on the neighborhood environment. That's not to say every gang member is out selling drugs, doing this or doing that. A lot of it is association, family, for the means of survival in a tough neighborhood. So.
Thank you, Munir. Munir Bahar from the 300 Men March. Doug Donovan of the Baltimore Sun is with us in the studio as well. 410-662-8780. Let's take a couple of phone calls before we go on and meet our next guest, Lance in Mount Vernon. We'll go to you. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, thanks, Dan. I was for that half hour, that fateful half hour on Center Street in Mount Vernon. I was present for that. And when you were discussing, well, who was involved in that? I saw those people firsthand. A lot of them looked high school age, very probably younger. I crossed the street, Center Street. I saw them throwing bricks and rocks into Trinacria, destroying that storefront. Consequently, they never touched the new 520 storefront because there wasn't anything inside to get, in my opinion. And then I was sort of letting that happen because I was trying to pick up my 5-year-old daughter a block away, and I wasn't about to get into that. And then I heard a scream from this innocent woman, Asian woman, in the middle of the street who'd been dragged out of her car and was being beaten on the head by three of these people. I turned around, yelled as loud as I could, and started running towards them. Fortunately, one of their, quote, leaders, a young woman, actually, was also reinforcing me, saying, no, you know, no, I think she was saying no violence here to these young boys. And, of course, then there were people driving and marching, both in this group, and some other males who were driving by, you know, basically threatened to shoot me because I was trying to help this poor Asian woman. At which point that this female leader said, you know, you better go. And I was like, yeah, as long as they're not killing anybody, I'll leave. Trust me. And that's what I saw. And then on my way back 15 minutes later with my daughter, they had continued up Cathedral Street and down Center Street. And they basically, as I was getting home, they were destroying Gallery Cafe and parts of Eastern Center Street.
I wonder, is that the same group that got into Ted's Music Store?
Because, you know, I think it was, because you told me that Ted said it happened at about 4:50, and I was thinking, Ted, it probably happened at about 5, because that's when I saw it.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, I think it was the same group.
And, Lance, you think they were young, like middle school or high school?
Yeah, I mean, clearly I'm not a great judge, and there was a lot of emotion going through my head, but they sure seemed to be in high school age to me.
Well, thank you.
And they did not, at that time, they did not have masks. I know that later on, to do a lot of the looting, they came in and they did have masks.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for what you did out there, Lance.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that call. 410-662-8780. I mentioned at the start of the show that going on today downtown, actually at this hour, at the state's attorney's office, which is at 120 East Baltimore Street, according to this press release, some ministers have gathered for a rally and prayer vigil that they're calling a police accountability vigil, drawing attention to the fact that an investigation is underway into the death of Freddie Gray. It's been going on for a while, and that the police commissioner of Baltimore announced a date, May 1st, right, Doug Donovan?
That's correct.
That the police would turn over their report to the state's attorney's office. We asked J. Amy Dillard, associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore, to join us today. She's been on the show earlier. Nice to have you on the show with us, Amy Dillard.
Thanks for having me.
Amy Dillard is an expert in criminal defense and formerly served as a deputy public defender down in Alexandria, Virginia. She also sat on the independent review panel that looked into the death of Tyrone West in 2013, who died while in police custody. And also a note here that you sit on the Ad Hoc Police Practices Review Commission down in Fairfax, and you had an interesting case there that you had to review as well, the case of John Gear, a citizen who was shot by police down there. We can talk about that in a minute. But first, I wanted to ask you about the process here. So the police conduct an investigation of the death of Freddie Gray. They turn their report over to the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. There's this, I think, this expectation in the air that somehow on Friday we're all going to be filled in on the results of this report.
Well, I don't think that will happen. The police are engaged in an investigation over a death of a citizen. It's complicated by the fact that the police are reviewing themselves and investigating themselves. But the reports, or the, I hear these officers refer to these more often as the book or the binder that's put together, you know, will include interviews that have been done with, I presume, all the bicycle officers that were on the street, interviews with other citizens who may have observed, interviews with the folks that were driving the wagon, the doctors, EMS. It'll probably have this preliminary report from the coroner in it. And it won't be a summary. That is, in my experience, it won't be a summary recommendation to the state's attorney. It'll just be the evidence that's been gathered. And of course, that will have been gathered, some people might think, with a particular bias or motive in place, but it'll have been gathered and it'll be handed over to the state's attorney, who in turn will make decisions about whether to charge or not charge.
What do you make of the fact that Marilyn Mosby has announced that she's conducting her own investigation? The state's attorney's office does employ investigators.
And that's not uncommon. In fact, I was on Monday, I was in Fairfax at the Police Practices Commission down there, and the the prosecutor in Fairfax County and the lead investigator who does the internal criminal investigations of police officers gave a presentation to our commission. And, you know, they explained their different roles. And there's no doubt that a prosecutor has the capacity to engage in investigation. In most cases, the police and the prosecutor work together. That is, the police are an arm of the executive. They are the investigators for the prosecutor. But the prosecutor does have the ability to do independent investigation. Not a lot, though. I mean, it's not like she's got a police force.
Doug Donovan?
Yeah, last night you had Billy Murphy talking a lot about lowering expectations for Friday, trying to explain the process in public, which is, I think, is a good thing to be doing. I've tried to get Marilyn Mosby to answer what the expectations are for Friday, but we still haven't gotten an official comment from them about what the public can expect on Friday, if only just saying we're receiving the report and then we're going to process it. You know, I'd like to just hear from their office on
right.
that.
Right. So let's talk about what actually might happen then. You get two investigations. I think it's interesting that she's conducting her own investigation. She's not an independent prosecutor. She's the state's attorney, elected mm-hmm. state's attorney. But it is kind of interesting that she has her own investigation. So she compares what she gets with what the police deliver. And then what are her choices there? Can the state's attorney in Maryland just, you know, bring charges against officers if they decide to do that? Or do they have to go through a grand jury process?
Yeah, so what's interesting is how differently these cases are treated from any other case where one citizen kills another citizen. You know, police officers routinely charge people with crime based on their own investigation and often on scant investigation. They take that to a magistrate. Magistrate issues a warrant, and that person is charged with murder, let's say, and they have a preliminary hearing, and then the grand jury meets, and then it goes on to trial. You know, that's the way the vast majority of crime procedurally gets into the system and works through the system. There are instances where prosecutors take what's called a direct indictment, where they go directly to the grand jury, usually as a product of a large investigation. I've seen capital cases charged that way, for example, where it took a lot of investigation before a charge was brought. You know, in these police cases, we never see an arrest warrant. We never see someone arrested on the spot. I guess we did in South Carolina, highly unusual. But we don't see that. Instead, what we see is people appearing to really labor over the investigation. And gather lots of evidence. You know, in Fairfax, the lead investigator said, you know, we want to be exhaustive in the way we investigate these cases. And I ask him, but you don't do that for citizens, you know, so why approach it differently? Of course, we know some of the answers to that. But I think that the state's attorney, when she's presented with this binder, can take a case directly to the grand jury. She could also go back to the police and ask them to simply issue a warrant and arrest whoever she thinks should be charged with a crime and proceed through the more traditional channels if she wanted to.
I want to ask you this. It calls for an opinion, counselor.
Try.
Yeah. Why not just go to an independent investigator? This question came up, you know, a special prosecutor or something. This came up after Ferguson. It came up after the Eric Garner case. Because state's attorneys, assistant state's attorneys, they all work closely with detectives. They work with police officers. They used to be in Baltimore until 25 years ago. The police districts and the state's attorney, the court, were all in one building. But at least that separation occurred. So, I mean, why not just in the cases where police officers are involved in the death of a citizen, why not just call for a special prosecutor? I understand you need money to do this.
Yeah, so
you need to establish money, funds for it. But
I think, too, you need a procedure. And I think that could be an issue for the General Assembly to take up, you know, to say in these types of cases, we have a fund set aside and a mechanism and a group of statutes that govern how the investigation should proceed. Maybe the state police should do it rather than the local police. These are just ideas.
Right.
And maybe, you know, a prosecutor gets brought in from another jurisdiction in the state, or someone off of a panel of people gets brought in. You know, the feds have a better system for handling special prosecutions, but that's because you tend to have a lot of inspector generals in lots of different departments that do these internal investigations.
So that is one of the types of police reform bills that failed in Annapolis this year, was to have a mechanism to have an independent. I think the bill was about the attorney general. I believe it was Kurt Anderson introduced legislation that didn't go anywhere, to have somebody conduct an independent investigation other than the state's attorney's office when it involves police.
Just before we go to our break here, when we get back, we'll take some phone calls from our listeners. Amy Dilla, just briefly on this case of John Gear in Virginia, I note here from the Washington Post on April 20th or so, the family of John Gear settled for $2.95 million. This is a wrongful death lawsuit over the August 2013 shooting of this man in Springfield. Right? Mm-hmm. He was a man from Springfield, Virginia.
He was. He was standing in the doorway of his own home. And he had been in a conversation with, you might say, a standoff with police officers who had come to investigate a possible domestic assault. Once they realized there wasn't a domestic assault or that he was at home alone, they asked him to come outside and talk to them, and he refused. And so they stood face to face for a long time. And that standoff ended with an officer raising his gun and shooting Gear in the chest and killing him.
Has anything happened to that officer in terms of charges, criminal charges?
No, and in fact, the public didn't even know the officer's name until after the family filed the lawsuit earlier this year. So filing the civil wrongful death lawsuit in state court in Virginia forced discovery in that case. And the county of Fairfax had to turn over evidence and ended up posting, you know, tens of thousands of pages of documents on a website, made it available to the public. But there's still been no prosecution in that case. The Department of Justice has been involved since 2013. They've been told that it will go to a special grand jury soon, but we don't know when.
J. Amy Dillard of the University of Baltimore School of Law, associate professor there, and as I noted earlier, served on the independent review panel for the in-custody death here in Baltimore of Tyrone West in 2013, a similar role she's taken on in Fairfax County, Virginia. Thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
We're going to take a break here on Midday. Munir Bahar of the 300 Men March is with me, along with Doug Donovan, reporter for the Baltimore Sun, baltimoresun.com, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back and take your phone calls. Welcome back. We'll go right to the phone lines. Irene's in Beverly Hills in Baltimore, waiting to speak with us. Hi, Irene. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling because I took my daughters to the protest on Saturday because I need them to understand that a people united really can never be defeated, and the ideas of civil disobedience when something is wrong. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. We went there from 12:30 to 6 o'clock. We walked with the most diverse crowd we've ever seen. We had members of the Nation of Islam, white clergy members, but most notably, I walked for 5 hours with members of the Bloods and Crips, and I know that because they were fully flagged and obviously members of the Bloods and Crips, and they were incredible. They were calm. They were collected. They worked collaboratively in chanting a call and response. They were disciplined. At one point when we got near Camden Yards, a variety of onlookers called them the N-word. They threw beer at them, and the members of these gangs talked to each other about believing in the process and just keeping going. At one point, one Blood and one Crip got in a brief scuffle with each other, and immediately all other members said, not today, we're united, we're going to get justice for Freddie Gray. When we got to City Hall, they were joined by other members of their gang who held signs that they had made themselves about believing in the American ideal of representative democracy and that type of message. At the end of the protest, I walked with some of them back home towards the area where the protest started. So when I saw them on WBAL talking to Deborah Wiener, I recognized individual members that I had spent 6 hours with walking in peaceful protest, and the things that they said to her were 100% true about the protest on Saturday. So I've read many people on social media and in comment sections of the newspaper saying, how can you believe the Bloods and the Crips? They're disreputable. Well, I'm a witness that every single thing that they said about Saturday's protest was 100% true. In fact, if anything, they underplayed how calm, cool, collected, and determined that they really were.
Thank you, Irene. Renia, what did you think of what Irene told us?
Well, I think that's accurate. You know, I mean, one thing that I can say out of even the madness, it's, again, when I was talking earlier about recycling the hope, you know, people are eyes are opening. You know, a lot of folks are coming together. The unity, I think, is very strong. Even, again, with my group being a very diverse group, you know, people are seeing the power in that, you know, and people respond to it everywhere we walk. So, again, I think even the multicultural diversity of the protesters, of everybody that's out there, is sort of rising beyond some of these old, you know, division classifications that we've had in Baltimore for years.
Plus, I think what some of the elected officials were saying that met with gang members and ministers, that were, what they were saying when they met with gang members was that they need to have this dialogue with these groups if they're going to make any impact there, if they're going to make any change, if they're going to get these young men involved in the process and help them understand how the process can work for them. But the flip side of that is, sure, have those conversations, have those dialogues, but why would you go out publicly and have the stamp of legitimacy of City Hall placed on gang members? What is the point of that? That's what some experts would say. You're going to empower those gangs in a way that you might not be able to foresee. So that's just the flip side of that.
Deborah in North Baltimore, you're our next guest on Midday. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a couple of quick comments. My husband and I, we watched the entire thing unfold from the very beginning Monday afternoon, and we stayed up late until just about midnight. And I really want to make a couple of comments. One, I at first really was kind of baffled, you know, where was the mayor? Where was the mayor? What was she doing? And then when she finally did, you know, step out, I realized that, yeah, she was really behind the scenes, you know, trying to get everything organized. So I really applaud her. I have to also applaud the police department. I think they did, you know, there was a lot of restraint. You know, you really can't use deadly force. I mean, these are teenagers. These are kids. They do know right from wrong, but, you know, developmentally and maturely, you know, their frontal lobe has not really developed, you know, to the point where they're, you know, where they're realizing that they're really screwing up. And I think it's great that there are leaders who are taking part in wanting to step in and guide and help these young men. I also told your producer, I think around the world and every society, societies are really judged by those who are the least or those who are the most disenfranchised. You know, you have to look at that. That's how you really judge a society. And when you see what's happened in Baltimore and in all the other states in Ferguson, you know, when you see this kind of thing repeated and repeated, it makes you wonder how a nation as wealthy as we are can allow this to happen to our future. These young men are our future. And, you know, we have to cultivate them because they're going to be carrying the torch. They're going to be, you know, the leaders in the future, and we have to support them. We have to have programs. We can't cut programs. We have to, you know, get into those neighborhoods and help these people. And I just want, you know, the black people in this city. I live in a predominantly black neighborhood. White people are with you. We stand with you. We stand behind you. We support what you're doing. We are here to help whatever you want us to do. And, you know, we want you to know that, you know, we care. There are some people that are negative, like the man that threw the N-word. Discount those individuals. They don't matter.
All right.
They're the little teeny tiny bugs. They don't matter. It's the other people in this city, the other white people and Hispanics and everybody. You know, we're a patchwork, and we have to work together.
All right, Deborah, thank you very much for that phone call. I got into one of these, the mayor should have done this and should have done that conversations yesterday when I was out on Pennsylvania Avenue, and it occurred to me, should have done this, should have done that. You know, the last mayor who had to deal with a situation like this was on a much larger scale. 1968 was Thomas D'Alessandro III. We don't have a lot of experience with this stuff. We have mayors deal with snowstorms. Right? Snowstorm is pretty easy to deal with compared to something like this. So I don't. And there's a lot of like Monday morning quarterbacking going on in the middle of the game still. So I wondered, you know, how constructive that is. Manil wanted to say something, and then Amy.
Well, I'll just say, but what these folks aren't talking about is who are the antagonists? Who are the opponents? You know, who is inciting these riots?
Well, the mayor and the police commissioner have both used the term outsiders, splinter groups, agitators from outside.
And it's true. And we know some personally that we've confronted, you know, on the streets in the past 2 days. So part of it is accurate. You know, yes, there are some insiders who are involved too, but there are a lot of outsiders who have agitated this.
Amy Dillard.
I just wanted to add, you know, I think there are a couple of different issues to stay focused on with regard to the police. And I think the most important one is how do police respond when their own people harm someone? And that's the investigation that I think causes a lot of the criticism from the larger community. No doubt there are a lot of people in the community who also are good critics of how the police treat citizens on an everyday way. But, you know, there's no doubt that that's some police officers who do that. That's not every police officer that does that. But where we get really focused is when the entire police department is responsible for investigating itself, then it's easy for that anger to spread.
But it is fair, obviously. She's the mayor, so she should have her actions, you know, scrutinized. Why did it take X amount of time for you to say something before, you know, after the riots started, after the violence started? Those are all fair criticisms. I think it's fascinating, though, the shift in the public dialogue from, you know, thugs and then apologizing for using that word and then going into this very sort of psychological analysis of these children who are responsible for
what's
happening.
You're talking about from the city leadership, you
mean? Yeah, the city leadership, yeah. And Frank Reed saying, you know, abused people become abusers. These are children who have lived in abusive situations sociologically.
Whereas the first instinct was to call them thugs, right?
Which is the easy political script to stick to. Like, these are thugs. This is a minority number of people who are doing this, which is true, but in terms of using the language of thugs rather than something more holistic.
City Councilman Carl Stokes challenged CNN on their use of the word thugs. And in the second hour of our show today, we're going to be talking about media coverage. And included in that is his moment with CNN, where he stood them off on that use of that term. Munir Bahar, I want to ask you this before the hour's up. What the 300-man march will be up to in the next few days? And take this opportunity to tell our listeners about what you do on an ongoing basis.
On an ongoing basis, we work to prevent day-to-day murders and homicides in the community. We really are trying to influence more young people to see value in not only themselves, but see value in other people. I say the word is humanity. We're trying to get folks to recognize the humanity in others and to not disregard that humanity because of something small, arguments or, you know, disrespect or these things. On Friday, we're actually going to be hosting an anti-violence vigil and rally up on Park Heights in Cold Spring, 7:30 p.m. On May 1st. And the idea is we want to give voice to all the victims of homicides this year in Baltimore who don't have hashtags. There is no protest for them. No one's saying their names. And we feel that, you know, that's sort of a disservice as a city to the families and friends of these victims who are suffering. So we want to give them voice. We want to acknowledge them. We're actually going to read off all the names of those who've been murdered this year. So that's our next activity on Friday.
Thank you very much for being here today. Munir Bahar is the founder of the 300 Men March, started a couple of summers ago after Baltimore was experiencing a very terrible June, July of 2013, right?
Yeah.
Munir, in homicides. And they go out on the street every week still?
Yes, just on Friday nights.
So thank you very much for being here. Also, Amy Dillard, professor, associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore, and Doug Donovan, of the Baltimore Sun. Thank you both for being here with us this hour. We have another hour of midday coming up, and we hope the minister, Reverend Dante Hickman, will be joining us from Southern Baptist Church. That's the church that was involved in the development of that community center and apartments for seniors that burned down Monday night. We hope that he'll be joining us. And also coming up on the show, Kay Wise Whitehead will talk a little bit about media coverage. And she's been out on the street and has some observations to share with us. And we hope we'll get some more of your phone calls and reflections on what's happening here in Baltimore, what's been happening this week. So that's ahead in the second hour of our show, 410-662-8780. Write down the phone number, listen to the NPR news, and then give us a call after you hear the news. We'll take a break here, and we'll see you for the second hour.